Hello, and welcome to the Game Production Community Podcast, where you are warmly invited to join us in leveling up and paving the way for sustainable and profitable game development in our inclusive, growth-minded community of game producers. Today, we're honored and humbled to have guest speaker Tina Mary speak on the topic of cultural inclusion. I'm excited to learn more from her about the meaning of cultural diversity and how our cultural values impact the way we communicate, plan, and get work done. After the talk, there will be a live Q&A. You can use the event chat channel to share your thoughts and perspectives during the talk and live Q&A. Please use the event Q&A channel to upvote questions others have asked and post any of your own that you'd like to add. This event is being recorded and will be published on the Game Production Podcast. It was made possible by our wonderful supporters and in particular by event producer Fitz Lewis. And with that, I would like to hand it over to Tina.
Judy, thank you very much, and to Fitz as well for your support. I'm really excited to be talking to this audience because this is my affinity bias, right? This is my group, my in-group, as far as I'm concerned. So my goal today is to maybe inspire and ignite your curiosity about the things you can do to be more effective working across cultures, about being culturally inclusive. As was mentioned, I'm a bit of a veteran. I spent over 15 years working in games development from 2003 to 2018. And most of that was with Electronic Arts, shipping AAA games. And I had a chance to live in Romania and Sweden and travel all over the world and work with global teams. And that's really what got me going in this area. And then in 2018, I was working with King Activision and I learned about cultural intelligence. So that's really started me heavily on this journey, and I'm really blessed today to have a chance to do training and public speaking and share the things I've learned over my career. As was mentioned, there are some slides, and I also created some additional materials for you, including a handout for cultural values and how we think about values as bias and inclusion. So I hope you find them useful. If you have any questions after the event, you can reach out to me directly. Let's take a look at what we're going to cover here. And in the event that you have questions along the way, please do go ahead and post them, and Fitz will help facilitate those for us. I'm looking forward to your observations as well. While I won't be looking at chat right now, I'm really excited to go back and look at your reflections and stories that you might share along the way. So we're going to take a look at what cultural diversity means and the relevance and impact of CQ, what it's all about. We're then going to move into an area called cultural values, and we'll spend a lot of our time there. We're going to spend about 20 minutes on that topic and exploring how we can see cultural bias and how that's going to help us be more inclusive and effective. I want to make sure that we make this practical, so we're going to get into some very specific tips on how you can both develop your cultural intelligence and also how you can apply it in terms of building inclusion and being more effective and having a better time in your life and in your workplace. And we'll close with a call to action. I hope everyone attending today will think about making a formal commitment, either with a buddy or even to the group, saying, hey, this is this one thing I'm going to do to take what I've learned today and apply it. So let's get into that first topic. Junie mentioned she's interested in this concept of cultural diversity. And I think we tend to think of cultural diversity in the context of things like our nationality and our ethnicity, where we were born, where our grandparents were born, and so on. But for the purposes of our conversation, I want to take us broader. I want to have you reflect on the fact that culture shows up across different age groups and the generations we were born in. Think about boomers, Gen X, Gen Y, and millennials, and our motivations might look different. Gender, disabilities, functional roles, artists versus engineers have kind of a culture in their groups, right? And producers, the company we work with, the FIFA team even was very different from the NHL team, even though we were in the same studio in Vancouver. And then whether you're maybe on a central team versus a core development team building a game also can change the culture of your team. So in all these ways, we can think about culture as maybe what's accepted and familiar in whatever culture group I find myself in the moment. So with that context, think about when you're working with a group that's very different from you, whether it's maybe, again, a different project team or a different functional role, different age group, different nationality, somebody who's very different from you. What makes it hard? What makes it challenging for you? And you might want to think about that, and maybe one of those jumps to mind for you, and you're immediately thinking, yeah, this is an area that comes up for me a lot. And we'll explore maybe why that is and what you can do about it. So let's get to this definition. Cultural intelligence is defined as the capability to function and relate effectively in multicultural or culturally diverse situations. It is a form of intelligence. This is one that has been researched over two decades. And anybody interested in the science and digging in to some of the comments that I'll make that are rooted in science and academia, I'm happy to get the research to you and send you on a path to learn more about it. I feel very strongly that cultural intelligence is the strategic link that we need to building diverse, inclusive, and equitable work environments. And the reason for that is diversity alone doesn't guarantee effectiveness. In order to be effective working with those different from ourselves, we do need cultural intelligence. This is the framework that I'm sharing with you for those of you who are looking at the stream. And the way the framework is built is that there are four capabilities that we can see consistently emerging amongst people that we can describe as culturally intelligent. And the four capabilities are CQ drive, CQ knowledge, CQ strategy, and CQ action. And together, all of these capabilities build what we call cultural intelligence. We need all of them. Let's take a deeper look. CQ drive represents our motivation. This is our interest working with people different than ourselves, our persistence when it gets awkward and we make mistakes, because we will, and our confidence that we'll be successful when I engage with somebody different from myself. So motivation is where we have to start with inclusion, and it has where we have to start with culture. We've got to want to work with somebody different than ourselves. Next, we move into cognition. CQ knowledge represents our awareness and understanding of how cultures are similar and different. How are the rules different in one workplace versus another? One nationality versus another? One area of the country versus the other? A different project team and so on. How does culture show up in the way we make decisions and get things done? A lot of training that you all have experienced in your career is likely related to inclusion, focused on these two areas. Am I motivated? And do I have awareness that there are different culture groups out there? And for me, this was always the challenge. And this is where CQ makes the difference, because CQ strategy moves us into metacognition. This is where we're going to do something about that motivation and that knowledge. We're going to plan for the multicultural interaction ahead of time. We'll have awareness in the moment. Whose voices are being heard? Whose aren't? How can I bring everybody into the conversation? And finally, CQ strategy includes checking our assumptions. What might I have assumed about this cultural interaction? What might I have assumed about you and your culture group? And was I correct? Do I need to maybe readjust my mental map for next time? And then finally, the fourth capability is where we really get into our behaviors. This is how we act to be more effective, to be more inclusive. It's our ability to adapt our behaviors, both verbal and nonverbal, to be more effective when we're relating with somebody very different than ourselves. Now I want to take you past the framework. So if you have any questions on the framework, now is a good time to post them, and I'll cover them at the end. And I want to provide an awareness of how does the framework link up to bias and inclusion. This slide comes to us from the Cultural Intelligence Center, from a workshop that I sometimes deliver called CQ Your Bias. What it shows us is an image that represents a message that Daniel Kahneman taught us in a book called Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow. And what it was really about is helping us understand that most of the time we spend our thinking processes in system one, our intuitive thinking. It's unconscious, it's automatic, it's effortless. If I say 1 + 1, your brain thinks 2. System two is our rational thinking brain. We have to take time to slow ourselves down, to push ourselves into system two. So bias can be triggered in system one, but we don't have to act biased. We can move ourselves into system two with intention. So the way we do that is with cultural intelligence. As we apply CQ, as we improve and apply our cultural intelligence, we reduce the instance of bias and decrease that in the way it shows up in our decision making. So we've set the context. Why does culture matter? How does it link up to inclusion? Now I want to take you through a little bit of a journey and start exploring what do we mean by cultural values and how do they help us see cultural bias? So first of all, what are cultural values? Cultural values influence the way we interact, communicate, plan, and execute on our work. Think of them as your preferred way of working and relating to others, words that you can use to describe that. They are driven by core beliefs and assumptions that have been built over a lifetime of experiences. They can be influenced by the generation you're born in and the events that are happening in the world around you as you're growing up and in your early adult years. What is really important to understand about cultural values is that while it's interesting to reflect on their source, it's much more important to reflect on the impact when we're working with somebody different than ourselves. So one of the ways we can do that is with something called a profiling tool. A cultural value profile allows us to visualize our personal value preferences or orientation between two dimensions. So in the image we see here on the screen, we've got individualists on the left, an emphasis on individual goals and individual rights, collectivism on the right, emphasis on group goals and personal relationships. Sorry, I mixed left and right up there, didn't I? And then we have an arrow showing, in this particular case, an orientation slightly towards collectivism. Now, there's no right or wrong place to be on this chart, and it doesn't mean you're more adaptable if you find yourself in the middle of these two. It simply means you don't have a very strong preference for either orientation or spectrum, but it certainly could mean that you would easily have difficulty working with somebody on either end of the spectrum. So there's no relationship between your cultural values and your ability to work and relate with somebody who's different than yourself. This is simply knowledge that we're going to use. In other words, CQ knowledge is what we're building here. So we're developing our cultural knowledge by being more intentional and thoughtful about what culture means. Culture is defined as our beliefs, values, assumptions, and behaviors. And as I said, we can dig into this by understanding our cultural values and how they show up in our beliefs, assumptions, values, and behaviors. So on the screen, we see a list of 10 different cultural values. I'm going to review about four of them in fairly good detail and talk about how they show up and give some examples of what you can do about them. In the handout that I provided, you'll see descriptions of how all 10 might show up in terms of indicators that those preferences exist and how we might be biased towards somebody with a certain preference. So that will hopefully give you some tools for insight. So let's take a look at a few of these. Power distance. Power distance is the extent to which you prefer a flat, egalitarian approach to leadership, which is called a low power distance, versus more top-down hierarchical leadership style called high power distance. So for me, the example that I'm going to share here, I worked with a team that was half in Russia, half in Vancouver. And what I discovered is I needed to be flexible about how my leadership showed up for them to be more effective. That Russian team wanted what they considered to be a strong leader. They wanted a high power distance approach to my leadership, which included me giving them clear and specific guidance to directions. They wanted me to have smart answers to the questions they had. Conversely, the team in Vancouver preferred a low power distance leadership style for the most part. They wanted me to be a peer who was going to ask them smart questions, not give them smart answers. They thought their voice should be included in decisions being made on the project. So there are some tips we can provide here for how we can tell somebody is one or the other. You might look for who's showing up in the meetings, who's deferring before the leader speaks, who's willing to ask difficult questions or ask or disagree with somebody more senior in the room, and how does that impact the way you facilitate that conversation? So if you're working with someone more low power distance, work to de-emphasize formality if possible. Recognize that they might want to be able to question and challenge authority and provide a safe place to do that. If you're working with someone who is high power distance, respect that they might prefer a more clear set of directions and think about who CC'd on the line and question whether it's appropriate to ask hard questions in public of a leader who's high power distance. Individualism versus collectivism. This is the extent to which you think of yourself primarily as an individual or as part of a group, which is collectivism. And that specific group could include your family, your work group, your political affiliation, and so on. So individualists tend to be more motivated by personal goals and personal achievements, as well as individual recognition. They tend to like working alone and are more comfortable with the responsibility related to this autonomous work. I had an engineer once tell me that he loved working in the systems area of the game code because he wasn't dependent on anybody else. He could just get his job done. This was a true individualist. A collectivist tends to focus more on the group goals, and their longer-term relationships and personal connections are very important to how the work's being done. A collectivist probably won't like being recognized in front of the group and put on the spot and praised for their input, because for them, they know it's all about the team effort and they feel it's respectful to acknowledge that everybody contributed. So I like to think about these preferences when I'm thinking about how to assign work. I might think about more individual goals versus with the Russian team, I gave more group goals, for example, bug fixing targets and things like that. And I also recognize that for collectivists, giving them an opportunity to work together collaboratively was important. Uncertainty avoidance. This is one that can cause a lot of problems in diverse teams and in games development. It's how we think about risk, really. It's the extent to which we prefer to be more flexible and adapt to changing circumstances, which is considered low uncertainty avoidance, versus high uncertainty avoidance, where we want to reduce and avoid uncertainty. We want a plan A, we want a plan B. We want context to understand why decisions are being made. So how are we going to know of a certain preference? Well, we might hear somebody who's low uncertainty avoidance say, I love a new challenge, versus somebody with high uncertainty avoidance might say, are we sure this is going to work? And we want to be really careful about the assumptions that we're making. What are we assuming about somebody who's high uncertainty avoidance? Do we think they're being rigid and inflexible, that they're not able to innovate? Conversely, do we think our low uncertainty avoidance colleagues are absolutely demonstrating too much risk? And then let's look at context. Context is another value that can cause a lot of conflict when you're dealing with diverse teams. It's the extent to which you prefer a communication that's explicit, clear, and direct, which is low context, versus communication that's more indirect and emphasizes harmony and saving face. And this is referred to as high context. In a low context culture, our words mean our words. We say what we mean what we say. In a high context culture, there's much more attention being paid to how things are said, what's not being said, body language, and so on. And bias can really show up here. For example, I might again say things like, can you be more specific to somebody who's very high context? But my colleague who's high context, they might be wondering what I'm not saying. They might say something like, let me think about that when I ask them a direct question. So really, when I'm working with somebody who's low context, I want to try and focus on the message and be explicit and direct where I can. In a high context culture, I want to provide an opportunity for silence and reflection. I should be maybe trying to pay more attention to what's not being said. Expressiveness. This is one I have a very difficult time with. It's the extent to which you prefer to hide your emotions, which is neutral or non-expressive, versus to show them. This is me. I'm very effective. I'm very expressive. I'm a terrible poker player. I have to work really hard to be more neutral and more non-expressive. In Sweden, the culture is quite non-expressive, and I've had a hard time adapting to it. I also found an interesting difference in a leadership context. A lot of North American leaders are taught Hey, show enthusiasm when you present, show communicates a charisma, show a lot of energy when you're communicating. But conversely, European leaders are taught, hey, curb the enthusiasm. You're not going to be taken seriously. They won't get, and this is an important thing to note, right? How we're delivering to audiences is important. Our credibility can also be eroded in the workplace related to this. I mean, have you ever heard somebody in the hallway say, they're always so emotional? Or conversely, you might hear somebody walking away from meetings saying, it seems like they just don't care at all. So for me, again, this is a very personal thing. For me, I had this show up for myself early in my career in games, where I at times was accused of lacking composure simply because I was excited, I was energized, I was maybe worried about something, and I was perceived to be lacking composure, and I needed to be calmer in my body language. So if you're working with neutral people, stick to the point, regulate your body language when you can. If you're working with somebody like me who's more expressive, try and show me warmth and trust. Maybe try and be a bit more expressive than you might typically prefer. Now, I want to respect the fact that we don't have a lot of time in the session, so I can't go through all 10 in that level of detail, but let's take a quick look at the last few. So cooperative versus competitive, the extent to which we prefer to achieve results in a collaborative manner versus in a competitive manner. So in other words, more focusing on the how versus the what, the relationship versus the task might be how that shows up. Time orientation, the extent to which we prefer immediate results versus results that come several years later. I see this conflict in games development often with teams, where teams are focused on sprints and milestones, and their leadership or studio is focused on three-year plans or one-year plans. Being versus doing is how we derive our energy. It's the extent to which we get energy through a quality of life versus proactively doing things and working towards goals. For my husband and I, we're on opposite ends of the spectrum, and it's kind of funny sometimes. He'll say, are you ever going to relax? My idea of relaxing might be puttering in my garden and ticking off some things on my to-do list. Universalism versus particularism is how we think about rules. It's the extent to which we prefer to apply the same standards to everyone versus the idea that we should make exceptions at times for friends or family or specific circumstances. And then focus. Focus is an interesting one, linear versus polychronic. It's the extent to which you prefer to do one thing at a time, which is referred to as linear focus, versus multitasking, which is referred to as polychronic. And the way I used to see this show up is, for example, meetings. People who are very linear will tend to end one meeting and that is how they show respect. Somebody who's more polychronic might allow themselves to be late for a meeting because they think that it's more respectful to finish the current conversation that they're in. You might also see somebody pull up their phone in a meeting quite overtly, and they're going to pull up their phone in the meeting and glance at it. That's probably a polychronic. The person who hides that gesture under the desk, they might still look at their phone, but they think it feels a bit inappropriate to do so. They're going to do that under their desk. That's a linear preference. So what do we know about cultural values? They provide us with a tool to describe and reflect on our general orientation to life, to work, and to our relationships. They give us some hints into potential biases we might have and assumptions we might be making around people who have different cultural values than ourselves. But our cultural values have nothing to do with our cultural intelligence. In other words, they do not predict our ability to work and relate effectively across cultures. This is purely knowledge that we need to apply somehow. So now let's figure out how we apply it, how we put CQ in practice. What tools do you have available to you to develop and apply them? So let's start with some strategies to develop your cultural intelligence. If CQ Drive is all about building my motivation to work and relate across cultures, then one way I can do that is make a list of all the benefits and things I serve to gain, the reasons why it's positive and enjoyable for me to work and relate across cultures. I can build a presentation. I can share that with my team. We can brainstorm and make that list even bigger. By doing that activity, I've boosted my own CQ drive and that of my entire team. CQ knowledge is about building awareness. So one way that we can do that is assess what is our preferred leadership style and does it work for everybody on the team? As producers, you have a leadership role, whether you're people managers or not in your particular organization. So how does your leadership style show up across cultures? One of the handouts that I provided to you, the very last page of the slide deck, has a little table that will give you some help in that regard. And if you'd like to know more, feel free to reach out to me. Another tip would be to review team jargon. We use a lot of lingo in the game development industry. Acronyms at Electronic Arts were insane. I promise you, the very first thing I did halfway through day one was go try and find a glossary of terms. And it wasn't just because I was new to the games industry, but also because there were so many acronyms that were unique to the EA culture. So think about reviewing them, documenting, and talking about them with your team. CQ strategy. This is about our metacognition. How do we apply our knowledge and our motivation? And one example of that is get explicit about how things are going to get done. And one area might be decision-making. How are decisions being made? Who's being informed? Who's being consulted? When are they being made? And how are we communicating that those decisions were made? Diverse teams will benefit greatly from that one action being taken. And then CQ action is about behaviors. And for me, the way that I work on my CQ action is practicing getting out of my comfort zone. So if we can practice a communication style that's very different or more uncomfortable, this is a way that we can develop our CQ action. And it's also a way that will help us become braver and more readily able to show up as allies when we need to act on behalf of somebody else who's maybe being mistreated or receiving inequitable treatment. So this is also where CQ action shows up to help us become more effective allies. So even practicing things like, for example, how might you respond to a typical microaggression or issue that you see happening in the workplace? Practice how you respond so that when it happens in the moment, you're more effective being able to do so. So what areas of the workplace, what operational areas can you think about applying the cultural intelligence model? Think about it in terms of onboarding. How is the team motivated to work with different people, different maybe external partners and so on? How are we bringing in new remote team members? How do we help them understand the culture of our team, CQ knowledge? What strategies are we going to make sure that we include them? What behaviors do we need to teach them about the cultures and norms on our team? Communications, how are we sharing and receiving information? Who's sharing what, when, and why? How are we collaborating? How are we innovating? How are we managing dependencies? And then, of course, performance management. How do we define what good looks like? Do we understand that? So, as you dig into this idea of how you operationalize and make CQ real for your teams, think about how does culture show up in the way I said, do decision-making, share and receive information. How do you assign and measure the work? As an example here for assign and measure the work, what I did with one of my external partners was we assessed how we were doing it differently. So we assessed their team. They assessed our team. We then compared our assessments and talked about it so we could become more effective in understanding what our assumptions were around what good looked like. We also talked about how, again, work might be assigned differently. For example, giving a sub-team a group goal of building an entire game mode instead of discrete tasks to each person on that team might be more effective. Feedback is another area where you want to think about cultural values and cultural intelligence. Continuous feedback is critical, right? Whether we're giving constructive praise or criticism, we all need it to learn and grow. But how do we make it culturally nuanced to be effective? When we used to work with a team in Argentina, I found that the direct, very clear, and what we call low-context feedback style that was being used by our engineer in Canada was really ineffective for that team. They were scared of everything they were doing wrong. They needed more of a rounded approach, almost like a feedback sandwich. They need to hear, this is what's doing well, this is what we're going to improve, but keep doing this well. And that type of feedback was more effective for them. And then again, effective meetings. So don't forget that in order to have all voices heard, there are very specific actions you can take and best practices you can employ to ensure that you have all voices heard. And I'm going to share a framework in the addendum with you about how you can do that. So to wrap up, what are the things you can do and what do inclusive teams do to be more effective and to apply cultural intelligence? First, they align expectations. And the reason that relates to CQ drive or our motivation is because the number one conflict we have on most teams is clashing expectations. The more diversity you have on the team, the more likely we're going to have different expectations about what needs to be done, about what good looks like, and so on. So by keeping aligned on the goal, we keep everybody motivated. We want to use celebrate our cultural diversity. We want to use our awareness of cultural differences and talk about them and share our stories and look at rich conversations about the similarities and differences that you're seeing so everyone's awareness can be enhanced. Find ways to create explicit processes for getting things done. Again, there are so many misunderstandings that can happen on diverse teams that by getting clear about how we're going to get things done, we can remove a lot of the noise that happens when we don't understand and have clear alignment on how things should get done. And finally, look for ways to use your CQ action to stop talking about culture and diversity as a problem to solve. And move it instead to a place where you can leverage and celebrate the diversity of your team. Go beyond tolerating them and strategically make this a catalyst for innovation, a catalyst for psychological safety. CQ is a developmental model that can help everybody have a better world. So, to close, before we move into Q&A, I want to think about what your call to action is, right? So I would be thrilled to hear from Junie or Fitz if they'd like to share anything that's being put into the chat. If anyone is willing to share, what one action do you want to take to leverage what we've started to talk about here? What's your own personal commitment that you're going to make to fostering cultural inclusion, engagement, and effective collaboration?
Letting this steep in a little bit for everyone in the audience. One thing that you called out during the session that resonated with me very strongly with regards to the strategy part, it's sort of the primary takeaway for me, is that is an area that I could really work on a little bit more myself, especially the sort of pre-event planning and then also mm-hmm. the post-event reflection are areas that I need to do some deliberate work on. I'll let it steep a little bit for what the sort of concrete action is that I can take. What I personally do is in my daily deliberate practice, something that I do every morning is I think about what I can improve. Maybe I'll put something in there about choosing a single meeting where I spend a minute or two just thinking about what my strategy for that meeting is. And then also a couple minutes afterwards to very deliberately reflect. And I think prime candidates for me personally would be meetings where I'm meeting a new team, new individuals, especially if I know that those individuals are located in geographies that I haven't traditionally worked with very much. Now that I've joined EA for the first time, I've really gotten to work with some teams from Romania while at the same time also working with their counterparts in Vancouver and been discovering the differences there. I think my meetings would have benefited from me being more deliberate about the upfront planning as well as the post-meeting reflection.
That's great.
So
that's
I think
a great example.
That's one for me.
Yeah, that's a great example. I mean, if I think about even the Romanian versus Vancouver team, for me, for example, I might have seen a difference, cultural difference, where the Romanian team would expect and anticipate a little bit more social chit chat at the beginning of the meeting, a little bit more, you know, what happened on your weekend, this and that, versus you might see a team in Vancouver have been more focused on, okay, let's get to the agenda. You know, and that would have been me, right? There was a time where I always was the person, let's get us on the agenda, right?
And I have to say that resonates with me very strongly, where even for me, a very low context person, I would enter a meeting with the folks from Vancouver and they would be very to the point, concise, to the point where it was almost rigid, where I felt a little intimidated to say anything. And then at the same time, with folks from the same seniority level from Romania, I'm exchanging cat pictures. So, you know, that strongly resonates with me as well.
That's a great example. Yeah, excellent. Okay, so well, let me, because we've got a little bit of time, what I want to suggest is that we take a look. So I'll wrap up what I was going to suggest for this talk is really remember that CQ is your superpower. This is really, as you develop your CQ, you will absolutely, I guarantee you will become more personally effective. You will be more engaged. Your team will be more effective. But more importantly, everybody's going to have a better time. You're going to feel safer. They're going to be enjoying their work and the environment they're in, whether it's a remote environment or you're in person or hybrid. CQ is going to help you create that safe place where everybody can thrive and everybody can be their best. And the other thing is, no matter where you feel you might be on your CQ journey and in terms of assessing your own cultural intelligence, anybody can improve it with intention. And I promise you that it's anybody can. And, you know, there are tools and training that you can take, but you can just do reading as well. There's a lot of information both on my website and on different things you can research on the internet about how to develop your CQ organically. So what I'm going to quickly do, since we've got time and before we move into Q&A, is I'll walk you through the addendum materials for everybody's interest. So there's two pieces of addendum materials that I've provided for this session. The first one is called the Cultural Intelligence Framework. And the second one is about how we can think about inclusive leadership and being flexible in terms of our leadership style as it relates to cultural intelligence. So the CQ framework, a challenge framework, the cultural challenge framework. Do you remember earlier in the session, I asked you what areas of cultural challenges are you experiencing? Is it about communication or discomfort in how we express our emotions and so on? So we can use that awareness of where we're seeing cultural challenges to apply this framework. And you might even ask the team to vote on where they're seeing challenges so that you can pick the one that they see as most dominant. So once you've chosen an area to focus on, you're going to ask the team to answer this question. Why are we motivated to address this challenge? How do we describe the opportunity or the challenge? What are specific examples of what is working or not working and effective in the way we do it today? What's the impact of this? We use our CQ knowledge to identify root causes. Are there cultural values involved in this challenge? What assumptions are we making right now in the way we're doing things? Next piece is, what strategies can we use to help address this challenge? What could we do differently to either mitigate it or fully resolve it? If it's an opportunity, how can we leverage the opportunity of our diversity? And finally, behaviors. What are we going to change in our practices and norms in the way we get things done to help resolve the challenge? So let me share an example. In this example, we're motivated because we find that the loudest voice wins in team meetings. We want to hear from quieter team members because we know they have a lot to contribute. We think a few cultural values are involved, things like power distance, you know, our willingness to challenge the leader in the room, individualism versus collectivism. Do I maybe prefer to think about the group context versus the individual? And context, how comfortable am I saying what needs to be said in the moment? What strategies can we use? Well, we'd like to specifically look at how we plan for those meetings, how we're running them, how we have awareness in the moment, and how we follow up. And the idea is that we're trying to audit how all voices are being heard. So what are we going to do differently to achieve those outcomes? First, we're going to make sure all of our team meetings have an agenda with details around topics that might require attendee input, making sure that people have a safe place to ask questions offline and be clear on what's going to be covered in that meeting. The meeting host is going to provide a mechanism for safe places to be questions to be asked privately. The actions that are taken, the decisions that are made, notes are going to be created to summarize and document, especially for those not in attendance, but even for those who are, so we can check for understanding on any agreed upon calls to action. So this would be an example of how you can apply the framework to any cultural challenge you might be faced with. And the last resource before we move into Q&A, it's a table that I provided. Again, this comes through the Cultural Intelligence Center. It's a table adapted from something called Robert House's Path Goal Leadership Theory. Effectively, what that theory says is that we should adapt our leadership style based on the characteristics of the task at hand. And in this particular case, we want to also nuance it to the cultural values of the team or the individuals involved. So if we look at this table, and I go back to that example I gave you for the team in Russia versus the team in Vancouver, the team in Russia wanted a directive leadership style. The team working on the same project in Vancouver wanted an achievement-focused style of leadership. So in general, I tended to lean on one style or the other, depending on which team I was working with. But I also had to reflect on the fact that not everybody in the Russian team preferred a directive leadership style. Not everybody from a culture is the same. So be careful about the assumptions that you're making with respect to culture. So thank you very much. I'm going to wrap up now and we'll move to Q&A. And in case it's helpful, I'll flip over to the cultural framework slide while we're doing this.
All right. Thank you so much, Tina. During all the talks of yours I've had the chance to attend, as well as our conversation since, I find myself learning and growing, and the experience is doubtless likewise for our audience. Before we head into our live Q&A, I'd like to alert the audience that you can still upvote questions others have asked and post any of your own you'd like to add in the event QA channel. And with that, I'd like to move into Q&A. A question that might be a good opener is, what circumstance helped you to realize or inspired you to make cultural inclusion and DEI a top priority for you?
Yeah, I think definitely, you know, my own personal experience in a minority gender role in gaming. My first meeting at EA, I was one woman in a meeting of 30 people. So that was interesting. Also being a lot older than many of my peers in the industry, you know, those were probably a starting place for me to think about inclusion, but really it accelerated as I started working with more and more global teams and my definition of inclusion and culture expanded. And I used to think about the mantra of, we need a one team dynamic, right? While I respected I needed to be flexible and agile as a leader, I still wanted to create the sense of one team. And I would say that the really big pivot for me for this work as a full-time goal was when I learned about the cultural intelligence framework while I was working with King Activision. And I realized that actually CQ was what I'd been looking for a very long time to be more effective supporting our global teams and build more inclusion and psychological safety for those teams. So that's really what set me on the path. Thank you for asking.
Very resonant. So, a question that was provided by a community member. What steps have you more commonly observed individuals take to improve equitable treatment and reduce toxicity in the workplace? And there's a bonus question afterward.
Okay. On an individual level, I believe the most important thing individuals can do is speak up, you know, both about what they're seeing and observing related to their own experiences and where they've felt the impact of inequity. Because when we do that, when we share our own stories, it makes it safe for others to express their concerns about what might not be working. And it also demonstrates through your own example that it's effective and appropriate to speak up and support others when you observe toxic behaviors. So it's really a question of leading by example.
I suppose that kind of already covers the bonus question. I mean, it's setting an example as an individual and also being a leader, because you're basically leading by example. Is there anything else that you would add about stepping up and how we as individuals can't just contribute on our own, but also be leaders for others around us to be allies?
Yeah, I mean, so let's make sure everybody's clear. An ally is defined as someone who's not a member of a marginalized group, but they want to support that group, right? They want to take action. And the key word is, as we said, is action, right? We need to be willing to use our voice, our authority if it exists. But another point we need to remember is don't expect your colleagues from marginalized groups to be your educators, right? Spend some time learning about what it might mean to be part of that group to best support them, but don't expect them to be your educator to do that.
Yeah, that's definitely one that I've had to learn myself, to first start by doing research on my own and not expect people that I ask questions of to be willing to spend the time and energy to answer my question. Because, you know, they have probably been asked that question 100 times and it's not their responsibility or to spend the time doing so. And there's probably plenty of resources out there that could already give me the basics.
Exactly.
All right. So another question from Yvette. What's the difference between emotional intelligence and cultural intelligence?
Oh, I love this question, Yvette. It comes up a lot. So emotional intelligence, to define it for everybody, is our ability to regulate our emotions to be more effective and to also interpret the emotions of others so that we can be more effective and adapt to their emotions. But emotion is culturally nuanced. So as an example, in one culture, we might be more comfortable expressing our emotions versus another. So how do I know if somebody's upset or happy or sad or scared? So that's where cultural intelligence picks up, where emotional intelligence takes off, because it allows us to understand how to interpret and regulate our emotions when we're faced with cultural diversity. I hope that helps. Feel free to jump in and ask a secondary question if I didn't quite answer that for you, Yvette.
The first thing that I personally thought of is that emotional intelligence feels a little bit more about our interactions as an individual with other individuals, whereas cultural feels like an interaction between us and a group of people.
Well, you're applying cultural intelligence one-on-one, Junie. Mm-hmm. Although
that's true.
What you are doing is you're applying your awareness of the culture group, the person you're relating with, that it might be different. So you have to, cultural intelligence allows us to challenge our cultural assumptions that allows us to be more effective, which is what EQ is doing, but it doesn't take us to that cultural diversity place.
Yeah, exactly. Interesting. All right, let's see another one. One that was significantly upvoted. Do you have more examples of topics or questions that we could practice? Maybe even add them to the handouts, such as the microaggression example that you shared. Are there other topics like that where you'd recommend that we give some very conscious thought on how we would respond to that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think I would go back to looking at the handout I gave you for the cultural values and look at where all the bias things show up, where you have possible biases, and then ask yourselves, as a group, as a team, is this showing up for us? And as an example, it might be related to your interviewing practices and how you interpret the answers of the candidates. I'm not sure. What I'm trying to understand about the question is it about the example I gave about microaggressions was about practicing something that makes you uncomfortable. Is that really what they're looking for? Is that the question, the heart of the question? They want to understand what other things they can do to grow their CQ action, develop their CQ action capability?
Yeah, so it was very much about how do I as an individual respond to a situation?
And, okay, right. Yeah, yes.
Hypothesize, like preemptively review situations that can be very triggering, that can be very controversial.
Yeah.
And then, that.
Yeah, it's a great. So another example. So again, go back to ask your team, and maybe you can create a poll for finding out what microaggressions or issues are showing up for your team. But another example might be when somebody's in a meeting and they're always getting interrupted. That we want to practice. What are we going to do with, right? Whether I'm the one being interrupted or somebody else is being interrupted, how do I practice dealing with that scenario? So that'd be another example of it. Right. When we hear, so I shared in the handout, the cultural values handout, some examples of where bias might show up. So when you hear those things showing up, ask yourself, where are they showing up? What part of the business are they showing up in? Is it showing up when we're doing a sprint review? Then maybe we need to analyze that. I hope I answered that question. I'm happy to have it elaborated on.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Just have to make sure that I let it steep a little bit. All right. So let's see. Another question from the community. Which communities and or diverse groups would you mention as needing the focus to be placed on them in order to receive more equitable treatment? I realize that's a little bit of convoluted phrasing, but which groups could really benefit from explicit attention?
Exactly. I think the need to focus on a specific group is going to definitely be different based on things like where is your studio located in the world, the size and type of team you have, the organization you work for, the maturity that organization is on their DEI journey, their diversity and inclusion journey. So all those things could impact where the priority might exist. I mean, if I wanted to generalize for the games industry, I would suspect we probably want to be focusing on things like gender, ethnicity, and sexual identity as our priorities. Based on my own personal experience, I think addressing ageism and age as a culture group and a diverse group should be considered as well. It's an interesting question because it's going to be different. And in fact, it's going to be different even if you... Sometimes organizations have solved the diversity equation. They're bringing in diverse talent, and the issue relates more to inclusion because we're losing the talent as quickly as we're hiring them, right? Or it's related to equity because people aren't being promoted. We don't see the right groups being represented, culture groups represented in the leadership, right? The diversity is not reflective of our community. So where we focus might be more important to think about focusing on. Do we focus on diversity, equity, or inclusion versus a specific marginalized group? Or at least a bit of both.
Makes sense. So we, in the community, we have discussed these topics quite a lot in recent events. So for example, we recently did a book club on a book called The Culture Map. And in that book, Erin Meyer, the author, describes that she believes cultural values are scales and should be considered relative to each other. Yes. So one culture on the far end could be considered a culture or could be considered on the far end, whereas a different culture could be in the middle. But for the culture on the far end, they would be on the opposite side, whereas the culture that's in the middle of the scale could consider a culture on the opposite side to be just as extreme. So from the one extreme to the middle and from the middle to the other extreme could have the same interpretation in comparison. What do you think about that? And have you experienced that yourself ever? Yeah. When you witness different cultures?
Yeah, exactly. Because so as an example, the cultural value profiles can be used, they can overlay areas of the world where you typically see culture clusters. So for example, Anglo cultures tend to be more individualist, low context, low power distance. And there's certain areas of the world where that might be true. But as you said, it's very relative, right? So you might have one culture that's individualistic, but in comparison to another culture, they're very, they would be seen as collectivist. Even though I come from an Anglo culture and predominantly most people would be individualists, I actually have a collectivist inclination. So, you know, I think what Erin's pointing out in her book is it's more important to reflect on, again, how might we be seeing things differently or doing things differently than what's the source of where that came from, right? Does that make sense? Is that answering your question? Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair. Moving back to the slide that you had about the one action, do you have any recommendations, one easy step, an example?
Yeah.
Something to put it in, make it even easier for folks, yeah. Put it in their lap, put it on there directly onto their to-do list. Any examples that you could call out of immediate contributions that individuals could make in their daily lives, their teams, their communities, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. I do. This is about my number one tip to apply cultural intelligence and inclusion on a day-to-day basis. Find ways to seek to suspend judgment whenever you're confronted with something different. And an example of that, when you find yourself saying, "That's weird," stop yourself and say something like, "That's interesting. I wonder why." It's a simple nuance, a simple change. One is respectful curiosity. One assumes there's something wrong with different. And then my second tip is you know, reflect on these four capabilities, this framework, and just pick one. Just pick one. There's a list here, right here in front of you. Make a list of benefits, assess your style, review your team jargon, make explicit decisions around how something's going to get done on the team. Practice doing something different. If you're a direct communicator, practice giving indirect feedback, both writing and verbally, right? So just pick one thing on the list. Just go for it. Those are my tips.
Good thing I already have one that I'll be working on. Okay. All right, heading into the last question. Question from Fitz. And of course, your slides and your handouts are, of course, number one. But do you have any other preferred resources, books, articles that you would recommend for the community to help educate themselves or their teams on these topics?
Yeah, there's a great book by Dr. David Livermore, who is the person that I got certified through this framework in, called Driven by Difference. And it's a book about how we can apply CQ to foster cultural intelligence to foster innovation on diverse teams. So I really highly recommend that book, Culture Map. If you haven't already read it, you know, you mentioned it, Junie. It's fantastic. It's so, Erin makes it very practical. This concept of culture and the stories that she shares really bring it to life. So highly recommend that. And the cultural intelligence website itself, there's some materials on my website, some blog posts. But on the cultural intelligence website, there's also a lot of free resources, materials, research information. If you're not sure where to go and you're interested in navigating or finding something very specific out, please do reach out to me and I'll be happy to point you to where to find it. But yeah, there's a lot out there. Gert Hofstede, if you want to dig more into cultural values, His work, Hofstede, is how the last name is spelled. He's like the grandfather of cultural studies, intercultural studies. So much great work.
Yeah, I remember reading some of his stuff.
Yeah, that's what his work. An engineer over a decade ago told me about his work when we were working with the Russian team, and that's what started me on this path of studying and learning about cultures. So kudos to Jana Patterson, anybody who knows her.
Right. And we'll make sure to ask you to write out those references so we can include them in the description of the upload of the recording. All right. And that was the last question that we'll take. With that, the event has come to a close. I'd once again like to thank our guest, Tina. You can find her through her website, tinamary.ca, thank her for coming to speak to us, sharing her insights and wisdom. Once again, I'd also like to thank our wonderful supporters, and in particular, our event producer, Fitzgerald, for their efforts in making this event possible. As mentioned, this event has been recorded and will be published on the Game Production Podcast. Stay tuned for more events in the future, and remember, your support and feedback for our events is always welcome. There's always a way for you to give back that fits your unique sets of skills and talents, regardless of your experience level. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Junie.